History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold. Boy, am I grateful the story we get to hear today did not go untold. Our aim has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We also want to preserve their stories so the rest of us never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we so frequently find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I don't know how many people listening right now have ever been to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, home of the Oglala Lakota, where today just 32,000 people are spread out across 3,500 square miles. But that reservation paid a heavy price in World War II. 23 men from the reservation made the ultimate sacrifice, including the cousin of the man whose story we get to hear today. It's been reported that Seth Irving was the last living World War II veteran from the Res. He passed away this week at the age of 103. But when you hear what he went through 80 years ago, you'll be amazed he made it home at all. It's been a decade since I had the privilege of sitting down with Seth and his wife Elfrida in their longtime home in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Elfrida passed away in 2020. Her ashes will be interred with his when Seth receives full military honors at Black Hills National Cemetery in Sturgis, South Dakota on August 11th. Seth once played football and basketball at nearby Black Hills State University. Today's episode will be a tribute to his remarkable life, and we start, of course, with memories of early years on the reservation.
Oglala Lakota, that's part of the Sioux Nation of Pine Ridge.
So there in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, what was your childhood like? What kinds of things did you do there?
There wasn't much of anything to do because even my parents didn't have good jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to school at a Holy Rosary Mission Indian School. I went there when I was first grade, and I stayed there at that mission from 1929 to 1939. I went to school during the winter months and work for my board and room during the summer months.
What kind of work was that?
All kinds of work, you know, milking cows and stuff like that. They had a blacksmith shop.
Oh, okay.
We helped make barrels, you know, and buckets out by hand at that time. I had several different kinds of jobs. Whatever they needed, I did during the summertime.
And here in New Mexico, people hear quite a bit about the Navajo impact on World War II, the Navajo code talkers, where their native language actually became a weapon in the war and was an unbreakable code that the Japanese could never crack. But for you growing up in South Dakota, you weren't allowed to speak a native language.
No, I was disallowed just about the time I started going to school. So my older brother, two of them, spoke fluently. But ever after that, all of us were forbidden to speak in school, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we never did learn a language that good. Just words here and there.
Sure.
Know.
You mentioned your brothers. How many siblings did you have?
I had three brothers and five sisters.
Wow.
In 1942, when I joined, two of them were already in the service.
Mm-hmm.
My older brother, Chester, was a MP. Because he had police training, you know. And then my second brother, he couldn't make it because he had an eardrum burst. So he was 4F.
Mm-hmm.
And then my third brother was in the Navy before I was. And I don't know where he went to, but I just know he was in the Navy.
But they both made it home, the other two that were serving.
Yeah, they both made it home. And everybody was home when I got back.
And you were pretty fortunate to come back after what you went through. We're going to hear about that, but I also want to touch on something that I think is significant. All three of you boys made it home from the war, but you didn't have any parents to come home to. You lost your parents at an early age.
Yes, I did. My father died in 29, and my mother died in March of 42.
And it was in 42, so you're done with high school by then. Your mother dies, and 6 months later, you join the Navy.
Yes.
What was it about the Navy that made you want to join that branch of service as opposed to another, so much that you would lie about your age to do it?
It was by accident, really. There were three of us young Indians who lived on the reservation. We knew we were in draft age, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to go join the Marines. But the closest recruiting office was in Cheyenne, Wyoming. So we hitchhiked to Cheyenne, Wyoming. All three of us kind of rotated, you know,
mm-hmm.
going down. People picked us up. Anyway, we got down there in Cheyenne. And here, the day we were there, the Marine recruiting station was going overhaul, you know, so they were closed for a week, and there we were with no money or nothing, and we was walking up the street wondering what we were gonna do. We were thinking of coming home, you know.
Sure.
And here there was a Navy flag a waving on the street, and so we huddled up and they said, "Well, we're just going to the Navy." So we walked into that door and wound up in the Navy by accident.
That's quite a story.
Yeah.
Well, I like to say God's plans are always better than ours, and that's a good one right there.
Yeah.
So you're 20 years old at the time, but you told them you were 21.
Yes. I did that because one of the three of us, he wasn't 21. He was at the same age as me, 20, and they wouldn't sign him up until he got his parental consent.
Right.
His parents were still alive, so he had to come back to the res, hitchhike back to the res, get his parents' signature, and come back.
Wow.
So he got into the Navy about a week later than we did.
So you saw what happened to him. You said, "I'm not going to deal with that, and my parents aren't around to call me a liar."
And no, we were already gone when when he got back.
I know this was a long time ago. Do you remember what you expected out of the Navy, what you thought it was going to be like?
Really, we did not. But I was just pleased with my Navy service.
I'm just guessing that growing up on a reservation in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, you probably hadn't been on a ship before you joined the Navy?
No, I never even saw one. So,
well, I'm sure that changed in a hurry.
Yeah.
And the first ship that you were on was the USS Endicott, a destroyer?
Yes.
What was that like, getting aboard a tin can and getting to know all these other sailors from all over the country?
Boy, everything from the time I left the res was all new to me, you know. Riding a train from Cheyenne to Farragut, Idaho, my naval training station, was all new. And, of course, the Navy training was all new. Everything was. I never expected anything of that sort.
Was it kind of exciting for you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was great. Like I said, I really enjoyed the Navy. But at that time, I think we were having 6 weeks of boot training, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when that 6 weeks came up, I wound up with hives.
Ah.
And so the first draft, they call them, when they assign you to your next station, you know.
Yeah.
I was withheld on that draft because of my hives. I had them under my arms, both sides. And then about a week or two later, I was on a second draft. My doctor withheld me from that one. And I don't know what those ships were that I was assigned to at our stations where I was assigned to. And then the third draft came up. I was on it about a month after I got out of boot training. I was assigned to the USS Endicott.
And you just answered what was going to be my next question. Have you ever figured out what other ships you might have been on? But who knows? I mean, there were plenty of destroyers that went down in World War II. You could have been assigned to one of those.
Yeah.
How long were you on the Endicott?
I was on the Endicott about 8 months. And we went from Bremerton, Washington, all the way around to Boston, Mass., and we escorted merchant marine ships all the way to Casablanca.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the Germans were still in North Africa at that time.
Yeah, you're talking about, what, late 1943?
Yeah, it was around May, June, July of 43.
So the U-boat threat was still there.
That's what our primary function was, to hunt the submarines down.
Did you ever find any?
We made several runs. Of course, we don't know what, you know, there was no proof of everything coming up, you know.
Sure.
But we made several runs on subs while we were going, and also while we were coming back with the empties.
Mm-hmm. And what were your duties on the ship? What was your battle station?
Well, I was just a seaman second class, so I was, my battle station duty was on the bridge as a lookout.
Mm-hmm.
I was furnished great big binoculars, you know, and so every time we went to general quarters, that's where I went, and my job was to watch for submarine periscopes and torpedo wakes, etc.
Yeah.
And that's what my job was during the period of general quarters.
That sounds like a little bit of pressure. That's your job to see that stuff, and if you don't see it, what are the consequences?
Yeah, I don't know. The seas were pretty rough,
mm-hmm.
and it was very difficult to identify torpedo wake. But we had a new instrument, was a sonar.
Yep.
Which you could just spot them. That's what we used to chase the German submarines with.
Were you involved in that part of it, or you just knew about it?
No, my duties were up above, you know. Most of them were in below the bridge.
How did you get along with the other guys on your ship?
Great, as far as I was concerned. I didn't have any arguments with anybody.
How was the food?
My food was great. Of course, at Pine Ridge, I was lucky to get some food.
Mm.
But in the Navy, I got good food. We escorted them empties all back, and there was a bunch on the Atlantic Ocean, and we picked them up, and we escorted them back to Boston.
You ever nervous or scared during that time?
I don't think I was ever scared.
Didn't really have anyone shooting at you yet.
Couldn't see anybody shooting anyway.
Might have been under the surface,
yeah,
but you didn't
know.
Yeah,
they were under the water if they were. Yeah. But there was several ships sunk by submarines while we were going, you know.
Not in your convoy, though.
Yeah, in our convoy.
In your convoy.
Yeah.
That has to be alarming.
Those German submarines were awful smart, by golly.
So in November of 43, you get transferred to a different destroyer.
Yes.
The Newcomb.
Yeah.
What was different about that ship compared to the Endicott?
It was larger.
Uh-huh.
It had more fireworks to it. It had five-inch guns. It had all kinds of anti-aircraft guns, and that's what I was on, was the anti-aircraft.
You were on the 40?
40 millimeter.
Had you had much training in that?
Yes. Well, I didn't have that training until I got to Hawaii. We had a new site, Mark IV, they called it.
Uh-huh.
And I was one of the selected to have training on that gun sight. And that was a new one, brand new gun sight. And they put it on our ships and attached it to the 40 millimeters, and that's where I was.
So you had a pretty clear understanding of what your job was going to be?
Yes, I did.
To shoot down enemy airplanes?
Yes.
Had you seen any enemy airplanes yet, though?
Not then, but later on, we used to fire on the islands, too, you know. We bombarded the landing areas 3-4 days before landing,
mm-hmm.
of the troops, and that was our job. But our primary job was to protect the old battle wagons and other big ships from submarines in that before we started to bombard the islands, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of clear out the sea, so to speak, before you bombard, you know.
What was your first taste of real combat, the first encounter you had with the enemy where you said, boy, this is real. I could lose my life doing this.
It was a small island, Eniwetok.
Eniwetok, okay.
Something like that.
Yeah, Eniwetok was out there.
Yeah.
So that's the first place. Eniwetok was where you first saw the Japanese.
Yes.
And from that point on, really for the rest of your time in the Navy, you guys were pretty much battle to battle, huh? Sailing from one island to the other to bombard a new one?
Yes, that's what we did. We bombarded the island, and we stayed there for about 10 days after landing. Then we would pull back and, of course, load up, reload ammo and everything, and then we're prepared for the next landing. And then we talked, and there was another little small island we landed on before we landed on Saipan. got through Saipan, we went on back to the South Pacific. We were down there patrolling for several months. And then we gathered together again with the bombardment group, and we bombarded Lady Goff about 3-4 days before troops landed there.
Right.
That lady. And while we were there, my ship was involved with the Sarigawa Straits battle. And we were credited with sinking or helped sink one of the Japanese's big battle wagons at Sarigawa Straits.
Can you help us understand what it's like in one of those battles when you're at that duty station, when you're on that 40 millimeter and everything is firing?
I have no knowledge of getting any fear or anything of that nature, even though during that battle I could see the enemy firing at us and missing 50 yards, 100 yards off of the ship. But I was on the 40 millimeters, so I couldn't fire.
You weren't going to reach them.
But I could see the torpedo men. We had torpedo launchers on both sides of the ship, and four of them, you know, and we made that run. I was up there, and I just watched the torpedo men release those torpedoes off of our ship into the sea. Of course, it was dark, and we couldn't see where it was going, but we could see them firing at us. At a distance, you know.
Yeah.
I never got scared or fear, or I didn't panic. You know, we did have sailors who got panicky, you know.
Sure. You say that. You know, you never got scared.
No.
Why do you think that was? What do you think it was that helped you keep your calm or believe that you were going to make it?
It must have been the training, because I never got fearful of anything. I just had a job to do, and I had to do it, you know.
Yeah.
On that Sarigawa, I didn't have much to do except the next morning when the sun rose, Japanese planes came over, and then we went to work and shot at all the planes that were coming in, hundreds of them. But we didn't get hit. We almost did, but we didn't.
When you're in a moment like that, the Japanese planes are coming in, and you know you might be one of the guys that prevents it from hitting your ship or from bombing your ship.
Yeah.
Do you feel an adrenaline rush? What does that feel like in those kind of moments?
I don't think I had any kind of adrenaline feeling. I just felt like it was a job to be done, and I better do it right, or else, you know. I suppose that one morning I fired at 50 planes that came at us, not necessarily our particular ship. There wasn't any kamikazes at that time. They weren't trying to suicide bomb. They weren't doing that. It was just about a month after that is when they started the suicide bombing all over the place.
It's time for our first break, but wait till you hear what he went through in the waters off of Okinawa in 1945, plus a few developments before and after. We're celebrating the life of the last of the Oglala Lakota's World War II warriors, Seth Irving. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode dedicated to Seth Irving, who passed away July 25th at the age of 103. It's been 10 years since he shared his incredible story of survival on Hometown Heroes. One of the things I asked him was if he had ever heard of the kamikaze phenomenon until he saw it with his own eyes.
No, I didn't anyway. I thought they were just coming to shoot at us and go home, you know, sink us or do whatever they had to do.
Do you remember when you first heard that term kamikaze and understood what it meant?
Yeah, it was after we got out of Lady Golf, and I don't know where they assigned us to, but we went steaming around places. There's another little island, and I forget where it was, and we were parked there getting refueled and food and stuff like that. And that night, we saw the first kamikaze. I heard of it. It hit a couple ships, but it wasn't us. They didn't hit us. They hit a couple of ships that were anchored. And, of course, they gathered this all together. After that, we went to Iwo. That's when we ran into a lot of kamikaze planes that started to come.
I'm just curious, trying to get inside your head, and again, I know it's a long time ago, but was that a game changer now to know that these planes weren't just going to bomb you or shoot at you, that they might try to deliberately crash into you or another ship?
Yeah, it made a lot of difference. I mean, you better shoot them down, you know, before. But they sure did hit a lot of ships.
So you get to Iwo Jima, and you guys were there quite a while before the Marines hit the shore, just shelling the heck out of that island.
Yes. We were maybe 3,000 yards off of the beach when they were landing, and we could see them land. Sarabachi was on the left side of where we were, and there were some little hills on this side of the island. The Marines were going in a line like that, and that's good and this little bit. And then we'd all shoot at that spot.
Right.
Even airplanes would dive at that spot, and it evidently was being pulled away. 15, 20 minutes later, come out and shoot another scud at them.
Mm-hmm.
And that killed a lot of Marines on that line to the air base.
Being there as long as you were before the invasion and knowing how much firepower was devoted to that island from the air and from all your ships off the coast, were you surprised to see how strong the Japanese forces still were once the Marines hit the beach?
Yes, I was, because it was just a little old. I didn't see how people could live on that island, you know. Yeah, I was surprised because of the terrain of that. It just was nothing but black dust and stuff, you know.
Yeah, volcanic ash.
Yeah, and that Mount Sarabachi, I don't think anybody could live on that thing.
But you guys didn't know they had all those tunnels and caves and that whole network in there.
No, we didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, everybody who was at Iwo Jima, I have to ask, did you see something flying on top of Mount Sarabachi? Did you ever catch wind that something had been erected up there?
I was there to see it. You know, I could have.
Yeah.
But I missed it. Several days later, I saw it, though, you know. The next day, I thought.
And I didn't mean, did you see it go up, but you saw a flag flying on top of Mount Sarabachi.
Oh, yeah.
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 You probably saw the second flag, which was a little bigger than the first flag, as the story goes.
Yeah.
And, of course, one of the flag raisers, famously, was a Native American, Ira Hayes, who I'm sure you've read a lot about. But just to see the Stars and Stripes, your flag flying on top of that mountain, did it mean something to you?
Boy, howdy, that was a great, we knew that they were cleaning them out by that time.
Obviously, the photo of the flag going up atop Mount Sarabachi, one of the famous, most famous photos of all time, if not the most. Mm-hmm. When you see it, if you saw it right now, what do you think of when you look at that image? Does it mean something to you?
Yes, it does. It kind of makes me proud, really. But I had a cousin, first cousin. His name was Clement Crazy Thunder. He was a Marine.
Uh-huh.
And he was one of the very first to get killed on Iwo.
Clement Crazy Thunder.
Clement Crazy Thunder.
Was he from your same reservation?
Yes.
When did you find out that he was killed?
After the war. He went to that Catholic school I went to, too.
Right.
He was probably a year or two younger than me. They buried him on that cemetery there at Holy Rosary Mission.
So when you're there on the Newcomb, you're describing for us what you saw with the Japanese taking out Marines as they hit the beach.
Mm-hmm.
You might have seen your cousin get killed. He could have been one of those Marines.
Yeah, could have been. Could have been, but I didn't know it at the time.
And by the time you did find out, you had been through quite an ordeal yourself. But when you did hear that your cousin died there, that same battle that you were involved in, how did you take that? What did that do to you?
Of course, I didn't know it until way later, and so it didn't have that much of an impact on me because there was a lot of people from Pine Ridge killed in the war.
And it wasn't that big a place to begin with.
Yeah, but Pine Ridge wasn't that big a place.
Yeah. So the sacrifice made by that town and that reservation was disproportionate.
Oh, golly, a lot of them in the service, and a lot of them got killed in the service.
Mm-hmm. Well, you almost got killed in the service.
I almost did.
Really stinking close, and I want everybody to hear this story. So you get through Iwo Jima,
yeah,
and then a month and a half later, you're at Okinawa.
Right.
And this is where the kamikazes went into a frenzy.
Well, they were coming directly from Japan, one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, they were coming off of aircraft carriers, which they didn't have anymore.
Yeah, they were out of them.
Yeah.
Thanks to the Navy.
They ran out of them. But at Okinawa, they were coming directly from the island of Japan. Now, we went to Okinawa about 3-4 days and bombarded, and then the Marines came and Army came and landed. Then we went on picket duty, they called. All the destroyers were lined up around, kind of half circle around the island, and we were on the northernmost part of that circle. April 6, 1945, approximately 4:35 o'clock, we got a report that over 500 kamikaze planes were leaving Japan.
And you still weren't scared?
No, we got prepared to fight.
Holy moly.
Yeah. And then, you know, we had a lot of aircraft carriers around. They released their, and they shot down approximately half of them, or a little over a half.
Mm-hmm.
So there's only about 200 or something got through into the ship area. And that's when we got into it.
So you're on your 40-millimeter mount.
I was on my 40-millimeter mount, but I wasn't firing on anybody because my ship must have been going east. The planes came from the north.
Mm-hmm.
And so the port side man, he was firing on them. But we were at a standstill because there was nothing coming past.
So you're just sitting there waiting to get something to shoot at.
Sitting there waiting for somebody to tell us there's a plane here or there. But the first kamikaze that broke through, I had a rangefinder. He was on the phone with the control. We told him where the planes were. And he would set the range on that gun sight. And he's the one that told me, he said, hit the deck, Seth. There's the plane coming. So I don't know how I did it. I unhooked, and I didn't hit the deck. By that time, it blew me into the water.
You didn't hit the deck because the plane hit your ship before you had a chance to hit the deck.
Yes. All I could see was planes coming. That's all I remember anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I must have lost it, but I wound up in the water.
So the impact of this kamikaze on your ship blew you right into the water.
Yeah.
Means the ship hit, the plane hit pretty close to where you were.
Yeah, it hit about the middle of the stack. And the stack that I was on threw me and bent over. And I guess that's what happened to me. But that rangefinder didn't make it.
A lot of guys didn't make it.
Yeah. No, I had a 10-man gun crew. I was the only survivor on that gun crew. The other gun crew, there was only one survivor off of that one. I was firing at it. And then after I got into the water, the propeller must have missed me by 2-3 feet.
So you're in the water, you're conscious, you're burnt, well, and this propeller is flying right at you? The propeller from the plane, or you're talking about?
Our propeller.
Your
ship.
You almost got caught in the screws of the destroyer.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I must have been underwater because I could hear it just mumble. And I came up, and that screw, you know, was pushing the water, and it just pushed me out of the way.
Wow.
It pushed me about 100 feet or more away from the ship.
I'm sure you're still pretty stunned and days, but how much pain were you in?
I don't remember being in any pain. All I know is that when I was strapped in, I had a steel helmet on, I had a capon jacket on, and all of my clothes were gone. I was bare.
You were naked in the water?
Yeah. I didn't have no shoes. I was burned from my hair was all burned off to about my knee, all on the front side, you know.
So the explosion blew all your clothes off, yeah. Your helmet off, yeah. Burnt all your hair off, yeah. And burnt you from head to knee.
Yeah.
But you weren't in pain.
I don't feel pain. I don't know why. I just didn't feel pain.
What went through your mind when you realized what kind of condition you were in?
Survival, I guess. That's when survival takes over. I was in that water from about 4:30 until about 10 o'clock at night. Now, that was the scariest part, because you start getting scared, you know.
Well, yeah.
Because of the sharks, etc. I was really scared. And during that period, from about 4:30, 5 o'clock, there was a burnt life raft came floating by, and I jumped onto it. I thought I was going to get saved, but there was nothing on there. It was just burnt. And I was riding it along like that in a ship, and in maybe 2-3 hours, and it was getting dark, and I saw a silhouette of a destroyer sitting there, and I noticed that I was going to miss it by floating, you know.
Yeah, you're floating on this raft, and yeah. It's going to take you away from the destroyer.
Yeah. So I abandoned the raft. I figured even though that ship probably couldn't pick me up because they're still under attack, you know.
Yeah, it's not like you can hit the timeout button, come pick me up. They're still fighting each other.
Yeah, and so I was just about ready to get to that ship, and it took off. Of course, on that water, it just pushed me back out of the wind. There I was with nothing, just swimming by myself. I didn't have nothing on me.
So you're naked, you're burnt, you've already been in the water for 3 hours, and now your chance at survival just
vanished.
Went away from you.
Yeah.
Did you think you were going to die in that moment?
Yes, I did. I figured I don't think I could make it till morning.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you hear stories about ships and survivors on life rafts for 4 or 5 days, some weeks, some. But I didn't think I was going to make it. Then it was pitch dark, and then I was floating and floating, and it was dark, and all of a sudden I saw a flicker of light, just barely saw it. I started screaming, you know. That light came right up to me, and they picked me up around 10 o'clock at night. And, of course, they gave me morphine and put me out within a half an hour, within 15 minutes while I was aboard that ship. I got up by the ship, and they were going to, guys came down on
a rope ladder?
Yeah.
To get you?
To get me. And they grabbed my hand like that, and that slipped, fell back into the water.
Did they just pull the skin off your arms?
Yeah.
Oh, ouch.
I was burned, you know. I didn't realize it either.
They didn't realize it either?
No, they didn't know it, you know. The next group came down, they raised me up out of there.
That had to be painful, or you were still kind of numb or in shock, huh?
I must have been in shock, because I don't even remember pain. All I remember, I was saved. I know that within 15 minutes, I was treated, you know. Whatever they did was right. The next morning, that ship transferred me over to a transport that was transporting troops.
Uh-huh.
Was converted to a hospital ship.
Mm-hmm.
And I was transferred to it.
It's time for our final break, but more of this remarkable survival story when we come back. Seth Irving's final honors will take place August 11th at Black Hills National Cemetery in South Dakota. We'll be right back after this.
When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing.
It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5555.
383328. Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Way back in 2015, I had the privilege of visiting with Seth Irving and his wife Elfrida in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, where friends and family are listening this weekend on affiliate KIVA. Seth and Elfrida enjoyed 73 years of marriage before her passing in 2020. Now they're reunited for eternity after his last breath, July 25th. It's been said that every day is a gift, but Seth saw the last 80 years as a gift, somehow surviving a kamikaze attack that killed the rest of his gun crew, burned him from head to knee, and left him naked in the water for 6 hours until he was rescued in the waters off of Okinawa on April 6, 1945.
You mentioned when you first found yourself in the water and took stock of the situation that you were concerned about sharks, about, you know, the enemy that was still firing away.
Yeah.
Did you see any sharks during those 6 hours?
Nope.
Good thing.
No. And another strange thing is I didn't see another body.
Nothing.
Nothing. I don't know if that propeller caught me alone and sent me out that way.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I looked and looked and looked because I was wanting to be picked up right away, you know.
I don't blame you.
Yeah. But I didn't see a soul. I was out there for them 6 hours alone.
6 hours.
Yeah.
How long did it feel like?
Lifetime, really. Oh, howdy.
I've talked to some guys who've been in similar situations in the water for a long time. And some guys will describe doing things to keep their mind occupied or thinking through different scenarios. Or some guys would say a prayer. They'd frantically, you know, try to get someone else's attention. What did you do? How did you pass that time?
I don't remember.
I mean, mentally. What was going through your mind? Were you saying a prayer? Were you saying, I'm going to make it? I know I can? I mean, how did you keep going? Where did you find that hope and that persistence to power through?
All I know is I had to survive, you know.
Yeah.
And I did whatever I could. I never saw a shark, and I never saw another human being in there. That burnt wrap was the only thing that I saw, and I should have stuck to it, but I didn't.
Well, what do you think would have happened to you if that raft didn't float by?
I probably would have died. I probably would have let myself die. I was never a good swimmer, but I stayed afloat.
And that 3 hours made a big difference, I'm sure, to have that raft.
Yeah.
Another question that comes to mind. Sorry for all my crazy questions. But you said something when that kamikaze hit. And again, you got the word that something was coming. And just before it hits, you unbuckle. If you did not unstrap yourself from that position, what do you think would have happened?
I would have been drowned because I think that, although that guy told me to unbuckle, and I did, and he didn't because he didn't survive.
He probably didn't have time.
He must have not unbuckled.
Yeah.
And went down with the...
So the whole gun mount went into the water.
Yeah.
So you would have been trapped, if not killed by the impact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or else drowned. Because I don't know how far down it went. But I know I didn't go very far in because I came up and I just threw some salt water out. But it wasn't that much. So I must have just went in and out, you know.
And just the fact that of your 10-man crew, you were the only one to survive and that the other gun crew had the same ratio. I mean, that in itself says you beat some pretty significant odds to survive.
Boy, hardly we did. Well,
how do you explain it?
I have no answer to that because 84 of my shipmates died that evening amidships. All those torpedo men, they were right in that, and that stack was above a engine room.
Yeah.
And it blew. That was engine room number 2. That blew the same time I got it. And all those guys didn't survive. There were some survivors. Of course, the first plane got me.
Yeah.
But there was 4 other planes hit that ship.
5 kamikazes on 1 destroyer.
Yes.
But it didn't sink.
It didn't sink.
Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
1 well-placed kamikaze was plenty to sink a destroyer, if not a bigger ship, at other places in the war.
Right. Now, those destroyers were really built strong.
Well, so that ended the war for you, obviously.
Yes.
How long did it take you to recover from all this, and what was that period like?
You know, I was all bandaged up completely, so I didn't see daylight after I got on board that ship. My eyes must have been burnt bad.
You could see, but all the flesh around your eyes was
burnt. I didn't
see
anything.
In the water, did you see
anything?
No. In the water, you saw the light coming to you and all that.
In the water, I saw it after they treated me.
Right.
And they put stuff on me, and they must have put bandage that thick on me. Or I don't know what they did.
But anyway, they bandaged you from your head all the way down.
All the way down. I was bandaged all the way down. I was burned all the way down. And so I didn't see daylight until I got released from the hospital at the Guam Burn Unit. That must have been 30 days later.
Wow.
So I was without sight. I didn't see anything. But apparently I could see, you know.
But you were just covered up.
I was just covered up.
Well, that's a lot of time to think.
Yeah.
30 days with no one to look at.
Yeah.
You can hear people, you can't see them. What did you think about for 30 days? Did you think I'm going to go back home and go marry a girl from my reservation? Or what were you thinking about?
I was just thinking about getting well.
Yeah.
I didn't think about anything else, you know, and I wasn't the only one. There was 1,000 burn victims at that Guam burn unit, and I didn't know that until after they let me out.
When I asked you about how hard it was for you, one of the things you responded with was you were thinking about those guys that got killed on your ship. I imagine you knew a lot of those guys pretty well.
Well, not really that well, but I knew them.
The guys in your crew, your gun crew?
Yeah. I knew the guys in my gun crew, and I knew the guys who slept in my quarters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was the quarters captain. I had to keep order in the sleeping quarter area. That was one of my jobs before I go to general quarters.
That whole time that you were in the hospital and recovering, did you ever have any contact with family at all?
No.
Nothing?
Nope. They didn't know where I was, and I didn't know where they were.
You were even?
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking at your record here, and this says you were transferred back to your destroyer, the Newcomb, in August of 45, right before the end of the war.
Yes.
What was that like to get back aboard that ship?
All that time when I was still in the hospital.
Yeah.
It was towed back from Okinawa all the way to San Francisco. And, of course, I didn't know where it was at. I didn't even know it was still afloat.
Uh-huh. So they bring you back to San Francisco, and then you have 30 days survivor's leave. And they call it that because guys who lose people close to them in combat have that time to cope with it.
Yeah.
What did you do for those 30 days?
That's when I met her. Came back to Pine Ridge. I don't know exactly how I did it because the train comes from San Francisco to Alliance, Nebraska, which is 90 miles from Pine Ridge.
Uh-huh.
And I must have caught a ride back. There were a lot of people from the tribe that was working in Alliance. They had a glider factory in Alliance, Nebraska, and a lot of the Indians from my reservation worked at that station.
Uh-huh.
And so there, I caught a ride back with one of them who was going back to Pine Ridge, you know. They left me there.
Were any of your family members there to greet you?
One of my distant family members was the only one there, so I stayed with her.
Tell me how you met your wife.
Well, I was home on 30 days leave.
Yeah.
And she was home for 30 days from school, nursing school.
Uh-huh.
We met then.
So the burn patient meets a nurse.
Yeah.
What caught your eye? What did you notice about her?
She was the only one left. I always say.
You'd known each other for a long time, yeah, but you hadn't thought of it this way before.
No, huh?
So when did you realize that you need to ask Elfrieda to marry you? Did you figure it right then on that leave, or did it take a while?
We got engaged, so to speak.
While you were home on leave?
Yeah.
You weren't going to mess around?
No.
And now you're almost to your 68th anniversary.
Yes.
What's your secret? What's the secret to a marriage that lasts for 68 years?
If you're a man, marry a nurse. She took care of me all of my life, so.
Well, and she's right here, so let's get her take on it. You'll find photos of these two then and now on the Hometown Heroes Radio Facebook page. But here's Elfrieda Irving. Does that story of his survival still amaze you after all these years?
Yeah, I've heard this story a long time, and I'm just amazed each time he tells it, but that I'm not surprised at him.
It's amazing that he survived, but since you know him,
yeah, uh-huh.
Why is it not surprising?
Well, he's a tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
He had a tough childhood, tough life. He never had a mother or father, you know, but I was from the same place. But I had a mother and father.
Yeah.
That my father took care of me. But he had no one like that. And his brothers and sisters were all good Catholics, you know. They went mm-hmm. to this Catholic school. And they all had kids. They didn't have time or, you know, to find out where he was, what he was doing. They were interested in him. And they were very fond of him. But nobody... It was just a tough life.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, and when you say that you're amazed, but you're not surprised.
Yeah.
What's the most amazing aspect to you of his survival?
Being in the water for as long as he was and no clothes on, and it's just hard to imagine.
And I imagine it's hard to imagine that you wouldn't have had this marriage, you wouldn't have had your children and grandchildren if he didn't survive that.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of all that? How do you explain it?
All I can say is he's a tough guy.
Uh-huh.
He's a good man, real good.
And I heard his secret to 68 years of marriage. What about you? What's the secret ingredient?
I don't know. The time goes by so fast because we just were married not too long ago, and here we are, 68. Everybody's surprised at because, you know, all marriages nowadays are not very lasting. And even the old-timers that we knew on our youth, they all got married and divorced, It was me.
You're the secret. Now it's revealed.
Mm-hmm. It was all due to me.
There you go. That's what he said. He said, marry a nurse.
Yeah, we've had a good marriage and a good life.
Yes, all those years in Lawrence, Kansas, where Seth was an administrator at Haskell Indian Junior College, what is now Haskell Indian Nations University, and enjoying northern New Mexico now in retirement. Let's get back to Seth now.
In those 70 years, have you had lingering effects of what happened to you there? Are there any things that you've had to deal with because of those injuries?
My answer is no. I don't know why. I just know that, well, I didn't like the Japanese for a very long time, but I must have gave up that thing because I bought me a Japanese car.
There's a purple one right outside with a purple heart license plate.
Yeah. I don't remember holding any grudges or anything like that towards the Japanese, and I don't feel sorry for anything that I done. They say, you're a G.I. Joe, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a G.I. Joe. I was born in a government house. I graduated from a government school. I went to work for the government. I went to the service for the government, and then I went to work for the government for 30 years, and then retired from there, so...
Yeah.
I'm really a G.I. Joe.
You sure are. I know that you lived it, and you've told the story for a lot of years. But are you ever amazed when you think about everything that happened and you realize that you survived?
No. The only thing I miss now is having that reunion with my
shipmates.
Uh-huh. The ones that have survived. But because there's only six of us left from the ship, that's the only thing I miss really the most.
Mm-hmm.
They all knew what I went through.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did, because they knew my story, and I knew their story, where they were at on the ship, and we never could figure out how we all survived.
When you found out that the Japanese surrendered, that it was all over, what did that mean to you?
I was in the middle of Market Street celebrating with everybody on earth. Yeah, I was
San Francisco, huh?
Yeah. And that place was plump full of Navy, Army, Marine, women, and everything, and stuff flying all over them. I was right down there, down in the middle of the street.
So you're on Market Street, and we've all seen the pictures of New York City that day.
Yes.
And there's sailors kissing nurses, and there's all kinds of stuff going on. You yeah. weren't married yet. Were no. you kissing nurses in the streets of San Francisco?
There wasn't nurses there, but there was women.
Yeah?
I was kissing everybody.
More power to you.
Yeah.
You know, most of us alive today were not alive for World War II. We didn't live it. We didn't experience it. We didn't see what it was all about or understand why you were doing what you did. Uh-huh. So what do you think we need to know to remember not just you and all the guys who almost died, but the more than 400,000 Americans who did give their lives in that war? What's important for us to remember and know today about what all you guys did?
Well, I really do think that every American boy and girl that become 21 years old ought to serve in the military, either voluntarily or otherwise, for at least 2 years. They'll learn a lot.
Well, before I forget, I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling me about it, telling all our listeners about it. What would you say that you are most proud of?
My marriage.
Having interviewed more than 1,000 World War II veterans, I've got to say that that answer is the one most frequently given over the years. Seth Irving, the last of the Oglala Lakota warriors of World War II. August 11th is when his legacy will be honored in his native South Dakota. I don't know about you, but for me, the challenges in my life look a whole lot smaller after hearing everything that Seth endured. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.